You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Literary Treks. My name is Jonathan Cohn, and I am pleased to be joined, as I usually am, by Casey Pettit. Casey, how are you doing today?
Excellent. We've got a new Star Trek book to talk about, so it's always a glorious day.
Yeah, we've...
Not glorious in the Klingon sense, but, you know, just glorious.
Well, before we get into our news and our interview, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place is to join in the larger conversation, the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Literary Treks. That will find its way to us. You can also find the network on X and on Instagram at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We also have a dedicated Goodreads group for Literary Treks. Join us there and you can see the books we've read and what's coming up. If you'd like to keep all of our shows coming to you, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. You can even become an associate producer of your favorite shows, just like Casey Pettit and Greg Rozier are for Literary Treks. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And lastly, please leave us a star rating and a written review wherever you get your podcasts. It's great for us and also helps others find the show. So Casey, for our only piece of news is that we have a new Star Trek book cover. Do you want to talk to everyone about it?
Yes. David Mack's new book, Echoes in Eternity, which is a Star Trek The Original Series novel celebrating the 60th anniversary of Star Trek. We got a cover release, and David posted it on his social media. I think he saw it on Amazon and said, I guess it's safe to share now. And so we've gotten to see it. And so definitely check it out. It's interesting. Like we were talking before we started recording here, that this is a hardcover book, so like which is actually kind of unique for non-current shows. But I think since it's the 60th anniversary of Star Trek, they wanted to make sure to go a little bit special with this one. But the look of the cover is very similar to other Star Trek original series books that have come out in recent years, such as Lost to Eternity, another Eternity book that was by Greg Cox. But yeah, this one's interesting. It's kind of, you know, we got the little bit of artwork that we got on it because it's just a big white field. But we got basically three eras of Spock and three eras of the Enterprise. And it kind of looks like a painted cover, similar to that we got for To Defy Fate, which we'll talk about here shortly with Dayton. But I don't know. It's kind of cool. It's not as busy as covers have been in the past, but very, very interesting cover.
Yeah. And that's coming out in November, I believe.
Yeah, I believe. Cause it got pushed back.
And it did.
Yeah. Cause it was October . Check Amazon, check Simon Schuster's website, check wherever you get your books, and pre-order it. Yes, I've already pre-ordered the audiobook. So I love listening to him while I read.
I assume that's still the same narrator,
Robert Petcoff. I don't know, actually, because I don't think it's said yet on the Apple app. I would assume so. I think January Lavoie has read some of the newer Star Trek books, but usually those are where there's like
female character lead.
Female character, yeah. And so this being apparently a Spock book, I presume it would be Robert Petcoff. So he's always great to listen to.
Well, you may have to wait to listen to that new audiobook, but you know what you don't have to wait for? Our interview with Dayton.
Well, Dayton, it is great to have you back for your newest book, To Defy Fate, from Star Trek Picard. And I'd just like to say before we start, you were the very first guest on Literary Treks, episode one. And I think that was about
100 years ago.
Yeah. It was for the final Vanguard book, I think.
The novella.
Was that it? I honestly don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and this is actually episode 400.
Oh, wow.
Believe it or not. So,
yeah, but you all have gone through a lot of hosts and stuff.
We have, yeah.
We have.
I think Jonathan and I are number 5 and 6 or something like that, maybe. Mm-hmm. So, but, well, thanks for sticking around with us and coming back all the time. We love having you and talking to you. So,
thanks for inviting me back.
Yeah. This is such a big, sprawling book that has maybe an... For the books, kind of an uncharacteristic title, like kind of main character in Wesley Crusher. And I guess main question to start off with is, why Wesley?
Why? Unhinged is a pretty good descriptor, I think, for this one. I didn't come up with that originally, but it seems to have stuck, at least in my brain. This book took a long time to gestate. There's two different ways to look at it. I originally pitched an idea with Wesley, the Traveler, married up with the people who, you know, when the end of Picard season 2 basically said that the Travelers are working with the people who gave us Gary Seven, you know, I fired an email off to my editor like that night and said, I have thoughts about this because, you know, I like to play with the Gary Seven people and I like time travel stories. And, you know, we've used Wesley in the books extensively, and I like the idea of marrying all those concepts together and seeing what I can do. At the time, that wasn't the right place for that book, I guess, so I just sort of stuck it in my file and forgot about it and moved on to other things and wrote a book or two in the meantime. And then after Picard season 3 wrapped, I was asked to write what would have been the first mission of Captain Seven aboard the Enterprise G, like after the year-long jump ahead at the very end of the series. And so I wrote an outline for that. And of course, this was in that time when will they or won't they create a new show to spin out of Picard? Will they do this on TV? And everybody was just sort of like, we don't know. We don't know. And so I, you know, with that in mind, I asked several questions. I was like, well, if they're going to make a show about this, this is a dangerous area for me to be playing in. But they told me to go ahead and write an outline, and they gave me some instructions on what I could and couldn't do. So I gave them an outline. This was the fall of 2024. And so Simon and Schuster liked it. Paramount liked it. Secret Hideout liked it. And then about a week later, I get an email from my editor. They don't know what they want to do. They're still hemming and hawing about legacy, and so they like your story, but they're not ready for it to go forward. And I said, okay, well, that was time well spent. And then so they asked me for another story, and I said, well, what can I do? And they said, well, you can use the characters, you just can't put them on the Enterprise, and you can't do this and you can't do that. And I said, okay, but there's like a whole year between the two scenes at the end of that last episode. Can I set something right after that first finale part, you know, that first ending? And they said yes. And I said, okay. And so I started playing around with the ideas, and I went into that folder where I keep all those half-baked notions that I don't do anything with. And I found the Wesley email. And so I started scribbling this and that and the other. And arrived at this idea, this unhinged idea that I presented to everybody. And once again, they all said, yeah, like, do that. So that's where we are. That's how I got here with this, oddball book that I've written.
Nice.
Yeah. A very long, tortuous development process. So.
Yeah. Well, and to basically come from a seed out of the end of season two and then to gestating it into the, you know, this time much later, which I guess time has no meaning to the travelers and everybody.
Well, they basically said I couldn't go beyond the stakes in the ground. Mm-hmm. Back to the Seven, Rafi, the Enterprise G. But they wanted me to use the characters. And I said, okay, I guess they had thoughts about what the cover would look like or something. So I just went off and played. They basically just let me off the chain, let me run loose and have a little bit of fun. And then when it was all over, they said they liked it. I said, okay. I said, now, if there is a legacy show, chances are enough time will have passed between then and the time that the show premieres that they will have accounted for that passage of time. And my book might not even been overwritten, won't even be overwritten by the screen canon. So that was a win for me. So you know how these things go. We write these books and they never, ever, ever come back and do something that might overwrite us, let alone 20 years worth of books. Am I talking out loud?
No.
But you were describing it as being unhinged. I was like, it's not as unhinged as Coda. You're never going to reach that level of unhinged.
I had two other people helping me drive that train off the tracks. So this one was just me solo. So
yeah.
So this book, we talked about it having Wesley as kind of one of the main characters. And it's set after the prologue puts us right into Wesley's farewell from Journey's End. And why did you connect that specifically? We don't get to see that interim period. Why'd you choose to structure it that way?
Well, it's probably because, mostly it's because the people who would be picking up a Picard book might not necessarily be familiar with all the shenanigans that we've had with the rest of the books over the years. Like, so in their point of view, they haven't seen Wesley since if they watch the shows at all, they haven't seen him since he left the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. For him to pop up at the end of Picard season two would be more of a, well, that's out of left field, versus the rest of the people who read the Star Trek books faithfully. And they know all the crazy stuff Wesley's been doing in the books all these years. So I had to kind of play a version of that that would account for that, at least in my mind, account for those people who were joining the program already in progress, so to speak. So that's why I brought that scene into the book as a prologue to kind of revisit and reground what they remember about Wesley versus what they're going to learn about Wesley in the next, in the next part of the book.
I think, connecting him then to the, Jonathan and I were talking before you got on, is it the Aegis or the Aegis?
That's how I pronounce it, is the Aegis.
Aegis, okay. Obviously that connection was made in the Picard series, but then we bring in the Metrons, Kovich from Discovery. He was kind of a fun character to see pop up, especially because there was so much mystery around him in Discovery that we never really got a lot of or any resolution to. The Romulan Supernova, plays a pivotal role here as well. Were you just like building on all these things and kind of trying to bring in all these powers that were connected, or was there kind of more strategy there and trying to make these connections from throughout the Star Trek history?
The connections came as I developed the storyline. I was like, this is what I want to do with this character. These are the paces I want to put her through. Oh, that character might be helpful with that. So in fact, in my outline, I had Paul Stamets as the other party who was with Guinan. Then at some point, before I got to those scenes, I had started thinking about it, and I'm like, Kovich would be fun. So I kind of called that audible, didn't tell anybody. I just decided to do that. And so I restructured those scenes a little bit to take into account his impact on the show. And he's always been one of these characters that I've found fascinating. I don't know if a lot of people know this, but their original intention was to show us in season three of Discovery that he was Daniels from Enterprise. In the season three finale script, that gets revealed. And then they pulled they popped the clutch on that. They didn't, or they pumped the brakes on that and did not make that reveal. And I'm waiting because I'm like, I can start writing about this if they make that connection. Yeah. And then we get to the season four finale script, you know, a year later. Remember, I'm reading the scripts for Paramount. Mm-hmm. And they do it again. Like, he's going to reveal that he's actually this guy. And so I'm all excited. And then they didn't do it again. And then, of course, we get to season five. And there it is at the very end of the episode and the series. You know, and I'm like, it's 50-50 whether they're going to do this or not. I don't know. And so I waited. And then when they finally do it in the script, I'm like, finally, you know, and it just sort of was, I mean, I'd known about that, 2 years or more, waiting for them to pull that trigger. And I was waiting because I was thinking, man, what fun could we have had with him if we had learned that earlier?
Yeah.
You know, not just on the shows, but in the books that were writing, the different Discovery books that were being written at the time. I thought that would have been a lot of fun to have. I would love to write just a Kovich book. I probably won't get that chance, and it's probably way too inside nerdy baseball for Simon and Schuster. But he was just his whole history and the way he's Daniels and the way they connected the temporal war to the temporal cold war and the traveler's involvement and all of that. I'm like, it was obvious that he should be in the story mix somewhere. So I just had to figure out the best way to use him. But he's also one of those guys where don't really know the extent of his abilities, don't know really what he is capable of. So and there's always a chance he could show up on Academy because, you know, we have this, right. We're still in this time frame where any character is on the table as far as showing up somewhere in one of the modern shows. So you kind of have to hedge your bets a little bit.
Casey was talking about all the connections and it reminded me that this is, I believe, you like your first hardcover that you've gotten, or at least first hardcover from Star Trek.
Unless you count the Kirk Fu manual, which I absolutely do because I'm a clown and that's me.
Right. But with that, I think a lot of the authors who have gotten, you know, that hardcover opportunity have really felt a need to like level up or the need to make it feel grander because of that, because it's a different type of book. Did you, and I know that it used to be that the hardcovers used to be longer back when it was back at Pocket. So did you feel any sort of expectation with that being hardcover, or did you approach the process the same as you always do?
No, it was definitely a consideration because, you know, a different price point, a different marketing strategy, or a different placement in the bookstore. And, you know, but most importantly, it costs more. So you're asking more of the reader. You're mm-hmm. kind of like you're sticking your hand out just a little bit further for the reader. So you feel, at least in my case, I feel like an obligation to level up, as you say. And I don't know that I called it that while I was working on it, but that feeling, yeah, I was like, this needs to be bigger than the story I normally get to write, at least a little bit more, just for the investment and hopefully the payoff for the reader. And I know some of the other guys who've had hardcover come out before me felt the same way. It's like, we mm-hmm. kind of do need to step up our game a little bit just to justify the, and I, you know, it's not like I have any decision-making powers about the format. I don't get to make those calls. I mean, I benefit from it because it's a pretty big deal for me to have a hardcover for writer to have a hardcover, because you're basically looking at multiple bites at the apple now. You know, there'll be a trade paperback in a year. There would have been a time when it would have been, you know, a mass market after that. And of course, ebook and audiobook and all the other things. So, it's definitely a consideration. I mean, I always try to write the best book I can with the time.
For sure.
Right. You know, but this, definitely was at the forefront, because I'm like, this needs to be a little bigger.
I noticed when I was reading the book that it had a lot of striking similarities thematically and tonally to The Last Best Hope from Una McCormick, which was the first Picard novel, which also dealt with the Romulan supernova. It dealt with the consequences of not addressing it fast enough, of the Federation's pullback. And I thought that was interesting because one is set, you know, before the series even starts, and your book is set at the end of the Picard series, you know, in that little flash period of time. So was there any conscious choice on y'all's part to do the to tie them together thematically, or did it just kind of lucky happenstance?
It wasn't a conscious effort, but I can't imagine it wasn't a subconscious effort, because I did go back and look through Last Best Hope because of, particularly because of the information about the Romulan supernova. I don't know if we've talked about this before, but you know, there was a backstory document that was written by Kirsten Beyer for the Picard writers' room ahead of season one. Had a mm-hmm. whole backstory that basically a writer's primer for the room for writers who are not familiar with the Star Trek history. And she laid in all the backstory, including the Romulan supernova and the events that lead up to it. And of course, this was the document that made me realize the novel line as it existed back then was doomed. But one of the things that they talked about was, you know, how the supernova came to be and why it happened and who caused it. And there was going to be this exploration of that, but it never materialized on screen. So we had attempts by certain writers to try to bring that into the books, and it kept getting pushed away or pushed aside or reworked or whatever. So we've never found out who or why was responsible for the supernova, right? And in the backstory, it was the Romulans did it to themselves as the horrible side effect of an attempt to create this planetary cloaking screen around their system and using the star as the power source. That, in a nutshell, is what was behind all of that. And then, of course, it all went bad. But I asked if I could use that backstory for this, and Kirsten and the folks at Secret Hat, I said, yeah, sure. Obviously, we're not doing anything with it right now. So I was able to incorporate that. But yeah, we had grand plans for that at one point, where there was going to be a whole book just for Rafi, where she would pursue this truth. And it would show how her career got derailed and how she went off and all the personal problems she endured. And all the personal sacrifices she had to make with her family and everything, because this thing just ate her alive. This conspiracy to prove what happened ate her alive. There was a whole plan for that, but it never materialized. So all that stuff is still on the table, and I'm over here looking, well, I need more meat for the bones here. So I'm going to go out and grab that. It was just, you know, there was just a lot of stuff on the table that had not been used. And I'm like, I can fit this into my storyline and have it make sense to me. So then the trick is to try to convince everybody read the book that it makes sense to them.
Well, and having the character of Lakara was really interesting, because she's then this kind of character kind of with a foot in two worlds, the world of the Aegis and the world of, I mean, she's a Romulan and she's got a husband and son living on the planet, and she's not supposed to be interfering in their lives. Or in anybody's lives, really. I guess, can you talk about the kind of the genesis of this character and kind of planting her in both fields as one of those villains who's kind of, you know, the hero of their own story, kind of, it's almost Nero in some ways, you know, kind of similar motivations.
As I've mentioned before in other interviews, it's like, I think the best villains or antagonists, if you will, you almost can root for them. Hmm. You know, I mean, you can't, even if you can't agree with their decisions, you can at least empathize with the situation that brings them to this point in their lives. You know, I don't like mustache twirling villains who are evil for evil's sake. You know, they're, like you said, they're the hero of their own story. They think they're doing the right thing for the right reasons. You may not agree with it at all, but you can't fault their conviction, as twisted as it might be from your point of view. She was also my way of trying to examine, what exactly are the Travelers and the Aegis doing out there? You know, we hear about them, and we hear a lot less about the Aegis than we have the Travelers. But, you know, they obviously have a form of a non-interference directive. But yet they obviously have grander goals that we don't seem to know or understand, based on how they decide they're going to either monitor or interfere with or otherwise influence events on different worlds at different points in time. I mean, for somebody to say they're not going to interfere, but then they send Gary Seven to keep the nuclear platform from, you know, starting World War III, there's a plan in place. But then the weird part is that even he doesn't really know the full extent of why he's doing what he's doing. He just knows he has to do X, Y, Z, or this doesn't happen, or this does happen. And he does that mission, but who's calling the shots, and what are they using as their playbook? And we still don't know a lot about them, even after all this time and all the ways they've been portrayed in the different media. All we have are hints. And so to me, that was using Lakara as that person with, you know, she's she's got her family and her personal issues, but she's also got the commitment she made to the Travelers into the Aegis as her conflict to kind of to examine another version of the Prime Directive, if you will, for better or worse.
Yeah, I mean, and she's, you know, she kind of, like you said, parallels Picard a bit, like, because Picard's bent the Prime Directive quite a bit for his, either for his own sake or for the sake of just the moral thing to do, or, you know, just to save lives, you know, where he needs to. And it's essentially what she's trying to do here too, in some ways.
I wouldn't say he's bent it or broken it for his own personal ends. I think he's broken it or bent it because he believed that was the just thing to do. I mean, insurrection is probably a prime example of where the Prime Directive has failed or will fail if we don't act. You know, it's like there's a moral imperative that you have to examine. And that's what captains are supposed to do, though. They're not supposed to just follow the rule book blindly. They're supposed to exercise their best judgment. And if they're wrong, they face the consequences. And he knows that going in, but he's decided that there's a larger, you know, greater moral issue in play when he does make those decisions. And I think the Travelers and the agents and the supervisors probably have similar conflicts within themselves about whether they should do or not do something. And particularly with Lakkar's situation, where she's basically comes back from the hell she experienced during the Temporal Wars, and she faces this new reality. And the expectation is that she will carry on like the good soldier. That's a lot to ask of somebody. I mean, even if somebody who's been trained to compartmentalize emotions and personal feelings and even put their family on a back burner while they go and execute a mission, that's a lot to ask of anyone. And not everybody's always up to the task, or not everybody's up to that task all the time. You know, so I tried to dig into that a little bit and examine the moral and the personal toll that such a responsibility weighs on on someone who's been entrusted with such power and such ability.
Yeah. Are we talking about Anakin Skywalker?
Yeah. Bad example, but example.
But it worked so well because I found, you know, once it was revealed her motivations, I found myself going like, I don't want her to succeed because she's messing stuff up. But at the same time, I get it. Like I understood it. Why she was doing it.
And that's the other part of the equation is, you know, obviously the Travelers, again, and the Aegis, they have some master plan that they're following. We don't know what it is or why it is or, you know, how the pieces fit together. But obviously the Romulan Empire fracturing the way it does as a result of the supernova is a key point in history. And the full ramifications of that probably are still not known. Even hundreds of years later, by the time what's left of the Romulans, you know, they go back and reunify with the Vulcans. It's like, was that the plan? Did they have to go through all of that to get to this? And what does that mean for the future? I don't know, you know. But I think Star Trek's a lot of fun when it leaves questions to be answered or explored, even after it solves the immediate problem.
And bringing the Metrons in to this, especially in the form of the child that's essentially, we find out, never actually trying to help Lakkar, but more show her that her efforts here are futile. And bringing that character in, was that just to have kind of, I don't know, like a moral center for her? Like, I mean, obviously she didn't take it that way, but just as another being that's kind of one of these all-powerful, all-seeing beings to kind of help us, I guess, even see the error of her ways.
Basically, I need a mechanism whereby she can influence time. She can make these changes along the timeline, but she has to do it in such a way that doesn't tip off Wesley or any of the other Travelers, because if she uses Traveler tech or Aegis tech to do what she's trying to do, they're going to be on in a second. They're going to be like, well, it's obviously one of us. And then it's just a process of elimination. Right. And then they can probably track her stuff and, you know, whatever, once she starts doing what she does. That opened as many cans of worms as anything else. I'm like, well, how the hell am I supposed to do this? I mean, I think I battled to myself into my recorder on my phone while walking around the neighborhood, like for a solid week, trying to figure that one out. I'm like, how do I get around this? And then when I arrived at the idea that it must be some other, you know, entity or mechanism, or and I didn't want it to be technology. Like, I didn't want it to be the Guardian of Forever, and I didn't want it to be you know, some other device like an Iconian gateway or something we've seen before, or something like that that we may not have seen before, but is obviously of similar notion. The Metron. Then I started thinking about all the different alien races that are all powerful, and all like the Organians, and then I find my way to the Metron, and then I'm like, well, it can't be the same Metron. We need somebody else. So that's where the idea of the kid, and then realizing that the kid could be a teacher and be the last teacher you'd expect, right? You don't expect the kid to teach you anything. We're all, you know, us silly grown-ups, we know everything, right? What's a kid going to teach you? Never mind, this kid's already lived thousands of years. But that was the idea, was that he would basically help her find her way to the explanation or the resolution of, like, the realization that this is futile, and hopefully do it in a way that doesn't kill everything and everyone.
Yeah, right.
So, but that's why he's there. He's sort of like that. He's got his, he's kind of like your driver's ed instructor, right? He's got the chicken switch over there on the right hand side. So, but he's letting her make the mistakes, knowing that he's got the ability to undo things before, or stop things before they proceed to a point of no return. But obviously it's in his power to allow her that room to do what she does, and hit her head against the wall and hit her head against the wall again.
So the book has, you know, that kind of time travel structure, and it sends teams into different crucial elements throughout history, including like the battle for Sector 001 from First Contact, which is an iconic moment from the movie. And we see other things like we see some DS9 and the Romulan supernova itself. But why did you pick in particular the Sector 001 as one of the core moments to include in the timey-wimey stuff?
Well, the obvious one is if Picard doesn't survive Sector 001, or, you know, if he doesn't survive that initial Borg invasion, then things obviously play out differently. People are in different places. Relationships don't happen. Promotions and assignments don't happen in different ways. So it starts a domino effect. And then it's the same thing with the fact that there's another version where, I know we're in spoiler territory now, aren't we? I think we blew past that stop sign like a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I know that you'll have a warning on the front. So there's the other reality where Picard died on the Stargazer. Mm-hmm. You know, so that changes things differently. So now it's Jellicoe in command of the Enterprise C, and which, of course, begets, you know, Wesley dies, or I'm sorry, Beverly Crusher dies, or whatever. And so these people aren't where they need to be to affect later points in time. That was the whole idea. In fact, when I first started writing the outline, my original idea was to have more of a mix and match with, I'm going to include some more familiar things that fans would be aware of, but then I'll invent scenarios that are not from screen. But that sort of started to spiral out of control. And even my editor was like, nah, keep it. Have fun with alternate versions of things the fans know. Play with that space. Mm-hmm. That way you've already got a lot on your plate here. I believe. You've already bitten off quite a bit here. Try to keep it reined in a little bit. So then it became a process of, all right, if this doesn't happen, or if this person's not present at this point in time, how does that affect down the line? Like, what are the effects? And that became the thing of, well, if, for example, moving over to Sisko, if Sisko's plot to get the Romulans into the Dominion War is exposed, that changes the whole tenor of that conflict. And it takes away the need for them to develop the cloaking technology that destroys their star. And, it, you know, of course, then they turn on the Federation and they weaken them to the point where the Klingons can come and conquer them. So it was just, I actually had a spreadsheet where I'm like, we'll do this and do that and do this and do this to put it all together. And that was just, then it just became a matter of making sure I kept everything straight. So especially toward the end, when I've got like three separate versions of events happening at once, you know, three different timelines, so to speak. And it was there were some wild nights there for a while.
It's fun just because it brings in elements from like like tapestry, because Picard's already kind of had some experiences where he could see, like, if things turned out differently, like, where would life have gone? And even the Krenim from Voyager's Year of Hell, and and destroying things from history to affect the future. And so I think Star Trek fans have always loved those kinds of what if, you know, type stories of, like, what if this event happened differently? Like, what would that look like now? Like you said, with Jellicoe in command.
And then there's another version of that, because I play with it. I put another wrinkle in the same idea a little bit later in the book, where, you know, because Picard did not survive Sector 001, he's not there for when the Borg attack again, or first in the first contact time frame. So, and of course, that, and anybody who's read the books will catch the, hopefully catch the little aside that I tossed toward them for the Coda books, because if you've read the Coda books, then you know why the first contact Borg fight is important.
So
it was just, you know, once I got in there and all the pieces were on the table, and my editor was like, well, you've gone completely off the rails, you might as well just see what happens. it was a challenge to keep it all straight. It was a lot of fun to keep it all straight. I love these kinds of stories, but I think this might be my last one of these for a while.
And the Cisco thing with keeping that information hidden was such an interesting discussion, because at one point you feel the need of, you know, maybe this would, it would be good to reveal this information, but you also realize that if you did that, it would affect the timelines and change things, potentially to make things even worse in the future. And so it's this question of, should we do this potentially somewhat bad thing of a cover-up to have a worse bad thing not happen, which is, to me, a quintessential DS9 plot, to a quintessential DS9 theme to explore. And so I really liked that, you know, of all the places that you could, you know, of all the stories you could have put that sort of thing, you specifically put it with the DS9 Cisco stuff.
The Cisco thing was going to be in from the beginning. I knew that. I knew that I had to play with that. It is such a linchpin moment in that series for Cisco to, granted, he's not responsible for the worst aspects of that plot, but he still goes with it, right? And he still harbors the secret. I mean, that's a dark place to go for Star Trek. Compared to what they've done before. And but the consequences of doing it and not doing it are just immense. And I felt like Picard would be the guy that had to be convinced, you know? It's like, because that dude is upright and moral to a fault. Yes, he's bent and broken the Prime Directive, but the man is fundamentally a man of honor, right? So for him to catch that in the face, just flat feet, you know, like to have that real, that revelation made to him that this happened and that's why he's still here and alive, is because basically Cisco did this. I mean, I couldn't shortchange that discussion. Like, they had to go in realizing that this is a horrible moment, but if it hadn't happened, then yeah, there'd have been, you know, billions more people dead. The Dominion would have probably conquered the Federation. It's an interesting moral question. I love the way DS9 handled it. I just wanted to make sure I didn't screw it up when I played with it. That was the biggest concern, was not to undermine it or minimize it or just take anything away from it. Cause it is definitely one of Star Trek's biggest moments, biggest moral quandaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was neat being able to see, like, our kind of next generation characters, so to speak, like, get to grapple with that, something they didn't get to really in their own show. And to see, you know, everyone's always like, who's the better captain, Kirk, Picard, Cisco, Janeway, like, you know, but they're also different. And like you said, seeing how Picard might have handled that situation, like he would have handled it completely differently, and he might have made a full report to Starfleet and
he probably let the would
ships
have
fall where they may.
He probably, I would, in and my so, brain, I think he probably would have. I think he's that guy. I mean, we've explored him in a fashion similar to that in the old continuity for the books. I mean, he gets outed as having been involved in Section 31 shenanigans, steps up and takes the hit, you know, when it all comes to light. And that's what you'd expect from a guy like Picard.
Yeah.
The guy that lectured Wesley on the first duty of every Starfleet officer being the, you know, to the truth, and then not taking the bullet when it's aimed at him would be so hypocritical.
Right. You know?
The book has a lot of really small character connections where, as you talked about earlier, how you didn't write it set after the series, you're set in that flash period, so there's not much you could do with them. But like with Picard and Beverly, and there's like a reference to the way that they're kind of reconnecting, but you also address where's Laris on Chaltok 4, and you also have a small connection between Seven and Rafi, but where you kind of leave it up in the air where they end up for the future. Was that stuff that was specific part of that outline that they gave you of what you could and couldn't do with them?
They didn't really have any comments about Rafi and Seven. I told them in the outline, I really want to explore their relationship because I always felt I was a big fan of Rafi's character from the beginning. And that might have been I might have been influenced by the way she was written in the original materials, you know, like the original the writer's guide and the scripts that we had. And I always felt she got shortchanged more as the series progressed, you know. And I mean, she gets her redemption at the very end of the last episode, you know, where her family realizes all the sacrifices that she made and all the things that she endured and handled and dealt with to keep everybody safe. That was a long time coming, and she totally deserved that. And so, but as far as her relationship with Seven, I don't know what it is about Star Trek writers and relationships between characters. Like, nobody can be happy.
Yeah. You know?
It's like, it's okay to have a healthy relationship between two people. I swear to God, it's okay. So I really wanted to have at least, you know, that. And then as far as Picard and Crusher, you know, they've got this long-term on again, off again. They obviously went through some things during season three of Picard, but at the end of all of that, they're much closer to being the friends that we know them as from the show and the earlier films.
Right.
And there's a possibility they might connect in a more meaningful way if the show had gone on. And of course, in the novels that we used to write, you know, they're married, they've got a kid, they've got all this stuff going on. And there's a segment of fandom that loved that relationship. And I kind of wanted to look over at them and sort of nod and go, I got you, fam. You know, that kind of thing. because I was a big fan. I liked writing that relationship, too. I was originally given that assignment to write the first book with Picard as a father. Like there were books where Beverly's pregnant, but they skipped over the whole birth part. And, but my editor was like, you just became a dad a couple years ago. You probably can write a Picard as a new father story. So, you know, so channel some of that sleeplessness and getting puked on and everything else and turn that into a story.
Which book was that one? That was the first.
Oh, that was the Typhon.
Oh,
pack book.
Okay.
Paths of Disharmony.
Gotcha.
Was the first one. And then it just seemed like I kept getting the Next Generation books after that. It was, I wrote Paths of Disharmony and it was a big political thing. And I said, okay, I'm not really politics aren't my favorite thing to write about in Star Trek. So, I lay out all these problems that they want in that thing. And then I move on to go write something else, probably a Vanguard book or something. And a couple of years later, they come back with the Fall, the miniseries. And I get to anchor that series with the last book again. And it's a political thing. Didn't we just do this like 2 or 3 years ago? And so, you know, and then I had the question of, well, if I can wrap up all these plot threads, can I please put them in a place where they can go be explorers again? You know, the Enterprise can go off and be explorers after this. Can I please do that? And I'll leave it as open as possible because back in those days, you didn't know who was going to write the next book. So right. It's like I could hand it off. It could have been Dave or it could have been, you know, Kirsten or Una or somebody else like that. And I left it as wide open as possible. And then a couple months after that, they come and go, you're going to write the first Next Generation book after all this is wrapped up. And I'm like, I could have set up all kinds of plot lines for myself if you'd let me.
Right. You know?
And then after that, I just kept getting the odd, I think I wrote 3 or 4 more Next Generation books in that sequence before we wrapped it all up. And I became the Picard Crusher guy. So, and that, you know, I'm evolving their relationship and their family and the kid, their fatherhood, motherhood deal as my kids are growing up too. So that was a fun parallel. But as far as for Picard, I wanted to hint back at that idea that, you know, they could reconnect, they could get past the difficulties that had separated them. I don't know. I'm a sucker for a happy ending when it comes to romance. You know, I don't know what to say. Like I said, I don't understand why we have to put their emotions through the meat grinder every chance we get. It's okay, you know, let them have some time for a while.
Yeah. I did feel like I think I did catch the little nod where Picard kind of ponders, well, I wonder what that would have been like if I'd had a kid with Beverly.
I tried to couch it a little bit, like Guinan. Yeah. Guinan would be someone who would maybe know, and I think we planted that in the Coda books, that, you know, Guinan and other people who can perceive time differently than the rest of us lowly mortals could know that there's a version of events out there that they don't know about. I mean, I tried to keep like, you know, there's probably a reality out there where you're married. Maybe you even have a kid. Nah, that's too far.
Yeah.
That's too much.
Yeah. So, as far as the ending of the book and with basically watching the supernova destroy Romulus, we know that Dalnok and Talis are at the lake. They gave their evacuation seats to someone else, and Wesley kind of feels like someone needs to be there for these people, like just at least to observe it, to witness this. Was that kind of where you always planned to take this book, like kind of to that end, or was that kind of one of those things that evolved as you wrote it and kind of felt just like the right place to land?
I actually wrote the ending first.
Oh.
Ooh.
I wrote that scene first. I had the idea in the outline that's where I wanted to go. I just didn't know how I was going to do it. But when I got started writing, I decided, and I've done this a couple of times over the years. I don't do it every time, but every once in a while, the ending just presents itself in my brain. Like I get it. I can see, I mean, I had the outline. It's not like it's a brand new idea, but, some of the particulars changed when I started actually writing it. But yeah, I had a pretty crystal clear idea of how I wanted it to end, and with Picard and Crusher talking during all of that. And then so I wrote that first and then set it aside. And then every once in a while I checked back in to make sure that I was threading my way toward that ending.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
And the book ends and Wesley has not discussed at all Spock's fate, you know, from the supernova creating the Kelvin timeline, which he of course would probably be aware of it, but Picard is not, even though we're now years after the fact with that. Was that a situation of that's just something you're not allowed to talk about with it, or was that we just decided not to throw in even another complication to it?
I figured that Picard didn't need to know the particulars about that. And then we know that Wesley knows about that timeline from Prodigy. He specifically calls it out when he's explaining to the kids all the different timelines, and he calls it the Narada incursion. So he's aware of all of it. And he's also aware of the Gold Key timeline. At least that's in my head canon. but so I kind of went back and forth about how much he should reveal, you know, because again, what rules do the travelers have and what rules do the Aegis have for that kind of like a prime directive, you know? But at the same time, it's Picard. So if Wesley can't trust this dude, what's left? But I figured I didn't need to go ahead and paint or connect all the dots. One thing, the reader knows what happens. That's the important thing. And then, but Picard can at least come away from that interaction knowing that it all works out. Spock's mission to reunify the Vulcans and the Romulans ultimately is successful. Takes a lot longer than anybody imagined, but it happens. And there's a lot of bumps along the way, of course, that he doesn't know about. Like he can't know about the burn, and he can't know about all of that. So because of that, I decided to couch it a little bit. But again, and also with the idea that the Aegis and the Travelers do have some rules as far as what they will allow to share, what they're sharing with people who do not have this ability or who do not have these mandates to do what they do.
With the title of the book, we don't know. I don't feel like we ever really talk about the titles of books whenever we look at these things. But To Defy Fate, if we look at a lot of the characters in the book, that's kind of what a lot of them are trying to do. Lakara obviously is really trying to defy fate throughout. But then there's also Seven taking on a command that she was once denied. Wesley, his whole life has been about where he's supposed to be versus where he obviously ended up as a traveler. Do you see the title as being about the folly of the defiance of fate, or is it kind of the human courage to kind of tackle that and attempt to defy the fate.
I think it's sort of like we all try to defy expectations. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of us grow up with expectations that we're going to do this. We're going to go to college. We're going to get a good job. We're going to get married. We're going to have kids. We're going to get rich. We're going to do whatever or whatever, or you're going to join the military and you're going to have a fabulous career and win lots of medals and all kinds of things. There's all sorts of expectations. And Wesley had a lot of expectations, we think, placed upon him just by virtue of his parents. You know, they're both career Starfleet officers. So the obvious answer was that was where he was going to go. And of course, that's where the ship or the show was angling him in his own way. He's like, he's this wunderkind, you know, so he's obviously going to go to Starfleet, but he's going to do crazy things in Starfleet. And then they introduced the wrinkle with the Traveler. And so which fate was he intended to follow? Mm. Which fate was really his? Was it supposed to follow in his parents' footsteps, or was he supposed to be a Traveler? Was that the way it always was? Strong evidence says yes, you know, that he was always destined to be this guy. That's one theme. And then, of course, the folly of what Lakara is trying to do is another way of defying fate. And then the Metron teaching her that lesson. So yeah, different sides of that coin. Yes.
Yeah.
Defy expectations, embrace expectations, you know, or invent your way around or through expectations.
Yeah. And I guess the question of two is who's defining the fate,
right?
that you're defying.
You're defying fate. Says who?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
One thing on the production of the book. So the book's dedicated to Margaret Clark, who was the longtime editor at Simon & Schuster, who sadly passed away last year. And you write in the acknowledgments that she helped you hatch this particular idea. How much of her fingerprints were on this book?
Oh, that she was everywhere. When I got she's the one who called me to tell me that my original outline, as much as they liked it, was not going forward. So, and she called me while I was driving somewhere. So I pulled in to a parking lot at like a McDonald's or something. And then we sat there for like 2 hours. I'm sitting in my Jeep while it's raining outside, talking to her, and we're hashing out what I can do. Cause I said, I've got this idea I think I can use the Wesley idea that we talked about. And then, so we just started talking and I just turned on my recorder while we talked. And so there was a lot of back and forth. She was always good at that. Margaret was always great at being a sounding board. So if you wanted to talk out your ideas, or you wanted to hash out a problem or whatever, you could talk to her easily. And she was definitely a co-developer of the storyline in a lot of ways. Like I would say one thing and she'd go, and then you could do this. And then I'd say, and then I could do that. And she goes, no, that's stupid. And so, you know, and so she was born and bred New Yorker. So she had a way about her that, you know, that, you know, when you cross the line, she'd smack you back. But she was definitely, not just for this book, but in all the books that she oversaw, she was to varying degrees, a creative force, whether it was like a mini series event where there were multiple authors involved or something like Vanguard when she took over those books, she was in the mix. Absolutely. And, you know, she was like a little mother hen. You know, she would check in on you at various intervals. And you knew after working with her for a while that, all right, I'm going to get to the 3 month mark. She's going to call me. I get to the 1 month mark. She's going to call me. And then there's the oddball calls where she just calls me to tell me that, okay, your contract is processed. Your payment is in due. Your payment is coming your way. So that's a 30-second conversation. But then the next hour and a half is about whatever we're working on, whatever's bothering her, whatever's making her laugh. And she, like I think I said it in the book, is she had a very dry, deadpan sense of humor. Like she'd slide it right between your ribs and you wouldn't even know it. And then, so it was always a goal of mine to get one good belly laugh out of her whenever we could talk. I would literally while away in the afternoon, I'd be looking at the clock, like it's 3:30 now. You call me at noon and I still have to So I do miss her dearly. And, you know, so she was, I've been very fortunate that all the editors I've worked with across the different books and the different publishers have been fantastic to work with, but she was very special.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, with that, I guess, any final thoughts that you want to get off your chest about the book or anything?
I put it in the book, right? I would like to call out the artist of the cover, Callus.
Yeah.
He did a fantastic job.
It was great.
For those who may wonder, it is absolutely not AI. It's absolutely a creation by his skilled hands. If you go to his website, CallumSeymour.com, you will see he does a lot of commercial art for book covers and album covers and sports and all sorts of things over in the UK. I got to see the earliest sketches. He was very open and receptive to any questions we had or suggestions we made or how we wanted the figures oriented. And he would provide multiple examples of trying to act out our ideas, not just mine, but you know, the folks at Pocket or Simon & Schuster and Paramount. Very, very, very giving and very patient with us and very talented, as evidenced by the book. It's an absolutely wonderful cover. One of my all-time favorites. Might very well be the best one I've ever had. Maybe the best one I ever get. I don't know.
Yeah. It's great that they're going back to the kind of original art again, rather than.
And I think that
just character posters.
I think that harkens back to what you guys said earlier. It's like, you know, it's a hardcover. It demands a little more oomph, and that includes a cover that's not a Photoshop or a filtered picture or a publicity photo or something like that. I applaud the effort on this cover.
Dayton, if you want to tell us, if you can, anything you got going on, anything in the hopper, or otherwise just how our listeners can follow you.
I have a few things in the hopper, actually, but I can't talk about any of them. I recently signed a book contract with a publisher that I've not previously worked. Tie-in property that I've not previously worked with.
Nice.
Ooh. So I am racing toward an insane deadline. At least it's insane for me. I'm about a month out from when the book is due. And I've only been working on it for about a month. So that's about
a
very accelerated timeline.
Yeah.
For me anyway. I mean, I'm sure there are people who could dash out six books like that, but I'm not that guy. They haven't announced it yet. I'm hoping that, I'm guessing there might be an announcement in and around San Diego Comic-Con. Okay. I'm hoping anyway. And then I've got a few other shorter works that I'm working on for different publishers. One is an IP project and the other ones are not. So they're keeping me busy. So yeah, it's a busy summer. I went from 0 to 60 like in 1 week in terms of my writing schedule for the summer. I'll let you know when I come up for air.
There you go.
And if you guys want to keep up with if anybody wants to keep up with any updates, you can always find my stuff at DaytonWard.com. You'll have links to all my social media and my various blatherings and whatnot.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Dayton, for coming on. Looking forward to anything that you've got coming next. Hopefully there's more Star Trek in your future. And if there is, we will be there.
Appreciate y'all. Thank you for having me on again. It's always fun to talk to y'all, whichever versions or combinations of teams that you all build for this particular exercise. Your all support over the years has been very much appreciated.
Wow. It is so great when we get these interviews with the authors. Like, I don't know, I was telling my wife about this and other people. Like, this is just such a fun part of this hobby, really, that we do, this podcasting hobby and reading, but to be able to talk to the authors and very generous with their time, and getting to talk about the books. So I don't know. I'm always super excited when we get this opportunity.
Yeah, it's always great talking to Dayton. And we got a few more months before our next new release. So in the meantime, we do have another book to talk about next time. We have been working through the Invasion series. We have already reviewed the first two, and so we will be reviewing the third Invasion book titled Time's Enemy.
It's about time.
that's our back-to-back timey-wimey books is a choice on our part. That was not intentional, but it worked out that way. I will say I've already read the book. I'm a little bit ahead, and I will start out by saying I will not spoil anything. But if I had a dime for every time, and I'm not going to finish that, and I'll finish the joke on the next episode.
That's how we'll start the next episode. Yeah, it's just with the second half of it.
Exactly. Right in the middle. So, Casey, where can people find you online if they want to follow you?
You can see my not quite defunct YouTube channel, Bookbuster Reviews. Jonathan's pestering me. I'm going to get back up on there and put some more videos out there. But I've got a handful in the back catalog there. You can find me on Goodreads at Knitting Trekkie. And you can find me on Facebook, just poking around, lurking in various groups, commenting from time to time. But Jonathan, when you're not going throughout history and looking at how things could have been in certain eras of your life, where can people find you?
My primary location is on YouTube with my book review channel there. It's just my name, Jonathan Cohn. And then I'm also on Twitter for movies and books, and apparently where people can beat me up over Bastards of the Universe. Woo! But you can find me there at Jonathan Cohn. And I have a Star Wars podcast, Two Sons of Tatooine, with my friend Nathan. We talk all things Star Wars. And I'm also on Goodreads as well, at Jonathan Cohn. So I'm very consistent on all the places. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And until next time, live long.
And read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.